Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Winter is on its way. Is your sidewalk shovel ready? If you live on certain routes in Superior, you might be getting a break. Plus, it's gone into legend as the Flying Dutchman of Lake Superior. But is the Bannockburn really a ghost ship?
It's a real ship with real people, and it will be found. When it is, I think it'll go a long way towards telling the story accurately and bringing some closure.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this. It's gone into legend as the Flying Dutchman of Lake Superior. But is the Bannockburn really a ghost ship?
It's a real ship with real people, and it will be found. When it is, I think it'll go a long way towards telling the story accurately and bringing some closure.
Plus, winter is on its way. Is your sidewalk shovel ready? If you live on certain routes in Superior, you might be getting a break. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. With the amount of snow we get in our region, we're all experts on removing it from our streets and sidewalks, right? Well, not always. And the piles of snow that we know are awaiting us, especially on the sidewalks blocking our view of turning cars or pedestrians shorter than 6 feet tall, are among the major hazards every winter. One city that has figured out what to do about it is Montreal. And last year, we spoke with them on the show about their innovative snow removal techniques, including the city taking responsibility of removing snow from sidewalks. They do so with special machines. And now, Superior has acquired the same thing. Here to tell us about them and how it'll all work is Mayor Jim Payne. Welcome to Simply Superior, Mayor Payne.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to point blank ask you, did you get the idea from our show?
No.
That was the idea of the show. We wanted to send a message.
I would actually argue that the city of Montreal got it from the city of Superior. For years, the city cleared snow from all of its sidewalks. This is something that a lot of citizens of Superior actually remember. And one of our city councilors, former city councilors, her husband actually drove one of these machines back when they were called bombardiers. So it wasn't even all that long ago that we did this service.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. I'm going to call them up and tell them that. Although they've been doing it a long time, I think since the 70s. But anyway, they're doing great things. And so I guess we are too. So what were we doing and what happened to it? Did we continue doing it or did we stop?
That is less clear to me. So the city definitely stopped. And I know that the city went through a long period of tight finances and cut a lot of city services and staff. And one of the challenges about a program like sidewalk snow removal is that it requires both equipment and staff. That equipment has to be maintained and replaced. And a staff person has to be paid to operate it. But we also have to have dedicated staff that can jump in those machines when it's time to clear, and we still have to have work for them the rest of the year as well. So there were a number of challenges that I imagine led to the termination of the program, but that doesn't mean the need went away. In fact, I would argue that it's gotten more acute.
Mm-hmm. And again, it is serious business because of what we said about you can't see. I mean, it gets pretty tall around here, and it is difficult to see around the corners.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But that's not even really the reason. That's an important part of it. But the fact is, even when the snowfall is relatively mild, say 2 to 3 inches, which is where we'll start clearing it. If even one person along a route is slow about clearing it or just doesn't at all, we have mechanisms to enforce that, but you could have days or even weeks where most routes in the city are just totally impassable. And that's what gets kids and senior citizens and any other pedestrian walking in the street. And that's just not very safe in the winter.
Mm-hmm. Is it responsible to leave it to homeowners and businesses? Because we don't ask them to do the streets. And, you know, there's certain things that we kind of, it's not even we want government to do. It's a matter of safety. And, people might be well-intentioned, but you're sick that day or you went on vacation or something like that.
Exactly. It is worth noting that when a sidewalk isn't clear, it's not because you have some lazy homeowner that refuses to do their part. I mean, that can be true, but it's usually like you described. It's something that just forgot. Or it's worth noting our rule gives you 48 hours, and that's two full school days a lot of the time. And that's the letter carrier having to deliver the mail 2 days in a row. It's me having to walk to work 2 days in a row. That's a long time. And some folks maybe are incapable. You know, there's a lot of senior citizens in this community that can't swing a shovel and clear 5, 6, 7 inches of snow, which can happen in a single storm. So it's something that's absolutely necessary for transportation. Sidewalks are public infrastructure. And in cities, we are in the infrastructure and transportation business. That's what we do. And to only prioritize streets at the expense of sidewalks is to only prioritize certain citizens, and it leaves a lot of behind.
Mm-hmm. And this also finally addresses that whole issue that you're not supposed to push your snow onto the street. So finally, if you're not the one pushing it, the city can coordinate where they put all that stuff. And seriously, it is an issue because by the end of the winter, trust me, my front lawn doesn't have right. more space
and
for this
that's,
stuff.
That's true. You know, you are going to have enough challenges clearing your carriageways and clearing out your driveway and making sure there's a path for the letter carrier. We just need to get people around the city. And we have the equipment and the staff to do it, to say nothing of the expertise. So, yeah, and we can make a plan that works for the whole neighborhood.
We are speaking with Mayor Jim Payne of Superior. We're talking about removing snow from the sidewalks, which the city now will take the responsibility of doing, at least to some degree. And I'm going to ask you what degree. And, to what degree? Are you doing it on all streets everywhere? Or
you know, it would be nice to do all streets everywhere. And who knows, maybe we will be able to get there someday. But no, we're not doing that right now. So we have two major limitations on this program. One is permanent and one is, I hope, temporary. So we're not going to roll out after every dusting of snow. We're only going to clear sidewalks after 2 inches or more of snowfall. That means that even if it snows 1 inch, it's still the responsibility of property owners to clean that up. That is still an impediment to pedestrians. And you could still find yourself getting that cleared by the city at your cost if you don't. However, the temporary part of it is we're only going to do certain key routes, the routes that we are designating as the safe routes to school. So they're common ways where a large number of children may walk to school, where we'd be able to accommodate a lot of kids getting to elementary and middle schools, and to a certain extent even the high school. Now, the hope is that we'll be able to expand that in future years, but that's limited by the amount of time it takes to clear these routes, as well as our ability to buy more, it's called a prine-off, the big piece of equipment that clears them, and the ability to hire more staff. So if our budgets allow that, we're going to keep growing the program and get to more and more streets. But we're always going to be targeting those high traffic routes so that citizens can hopefully never be too far from a sidewalk that's clear.
Do you have a map?
We do. If you go to the City of Superior website and the Streets Department page, you'll be able to find both the overarching map and a more detailed view with the street so you can find out if your street is on the route. But in addition to that, we're going to deliver postcards to all the folks that are on the route so that they know it's coming and so that they can, you know, trim up their sidewalks, any bushes and things like that to clear out for the machine.
Mm-hmm. So cost, you mentioned cost. How much is it going to cost? Tell me about these machines.
Yeah, so the Public Works Committee spent a lot of time working with the Streets Department to investigate a lot of different machines. They settled on this little tracked vehicle called a Prinoth. It runs on tracks like a tank and has a couple of adapters, including a giant snow blower or a V plow that can clear the snow out of the sidewalk, depending on how deep it is. Can get through just about anything. And that costs about $175,000. So you can see why it's going to take a while to build this program up. It's a very specialized piece of equipment, but even almost as expensive as the person that drives it. And so we hire park staff, we expand our parks crew so that we've got a person that can actually operate the machine. And we actually did the expansion of the parks crew a few years ago by converting seasonal crew into full-time. And that actually works for citizens year-round because this person's only going to be in the Prinoth after it snows, and that's only a few days of the year. But the rest of the year, this is a person that can be in the trucks helping to clear those giant snowbanks that you mentioned. They can be in the parks in the summertime, mowing the lawns and cleaning out the trash and doing all of that parks, rec, and forestry work that we do all year long, making it a great place to live for folks.
How many Prinoths did we order?
Just one.
Oh, all right. Well, that one is going to be a little bit busy, but you're going to make sure of that, right?
Yep.
Will it blow the snow into the street, by the way, and then maybe coordinate it with the street snow removal? That's what Montreal does.
Yep. It depends on the route and how much snow. So if it's small amounts of snow, just a few inches, we're going to use a V-plow, much like you see on the street. And we're going to plow it to either side of the sidewalk and just build up little snowbanks. Once the snow starts getting deeper, though, we're going to use the blower attachment. Depending on where it is, that could go into the street, and then we'll rely on the plows to clear it back, push it back, and then eventually clear it. But that blower is a little is still somewhat short, and that could still end up on the boulevard.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard our show last year, but one of the things that Montreal does, which is the most innovative I've ever heard, is they put it into the sewer system. And they time it with the coffee breaks of downtown Montreal. So, yep, when that warm water in wastewater, shall we say, makes it into the system, because Montreal is similar to us, it's like really cold, it thaws out or keeps the sewer flowing. And it's absolutely brilliant. In fact, last year was an issue because downtown was not as populated as it would have been because of COVID.
Sure. Yeah. You know, if we could establish a uniform coffee break in Superior, I think that would be a viable solution. The only thing is we would not do that because we've been spending the last few decades, really, but especially the last few years, separating our stormwater and our wastewater systems. Right, and snow is largely stormwater. It will melt and become runoff. And so we have especially sidewalk snow, which on the whole doesn't have as much of the sediment as the snow that we plow out of the street, which has the sand and the debris from cars and oil. So a lot of that will end up in our stormwater system and eventually make its way back to Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm. We are speaking with Mayor Jim Payne of Superior. We're talking about snow removal, particularly snow removal from sidewalks. And if you are lucky on the lucky route, how you won't have to do it anymore because the city is resuming the practice thanks to its brand new machine, and maybe they'll get more of it. You mentioned the cost to consumers or, I guess, businesses. So are there people who can have it done for them and pay it?
Sort of, but not really. You're not going to want it. So we don't have a fine per se if you don't clear your sidewalk when you're otherwise required to. What happens is our code compliance officer will have it cleared for you. And generally, we will only clear, you know, the public right-of-way sidewalks. We don't fine them all, but if somebody complains about you not clearing your sidewalk, code compliance officer may go out there and check it out. She also walks around some of the high traffic routes to make sure people are clearing it. And if our contractor is sent out there to clear it for you, if it's past the 48 hours and you haven't done it, we're going to send you the bill for that. And it's going to have a pretty hefty administrative fee. So you could find yourself facing a $200 or more bill for every time we have to clear your sidewalk for you. So I wouldn't rely on us to do it. It would be much cheaper to just hire the contractor yourself.
Right. And again, you're talking about people who would not be on the route where that machine is going, correct?
Well, and sometimes even then, because again, we will only clear the routes after 2 inches or more of snowfall. But if there has been a snowfall and it is less than 2 inches, but still creates a barrier, which most of it does, you are required to clear that. So you got to kind of watch the weather and see how much is out there. And it's still a good idea to go brush that off with your shovel. We're just going to make sure that it gets cleared when the snow starts piling up.
Okay. We are definitely looking forward to this. And the pleasant sounds of the, again, what's it?
The Prynoth.
The Prynoth on the streets and sidewalks of Superior. Anything else?
You know what? There's a couple names involved. I'm leading a lot of the press on this, but it was the Public Works Committee, which was all women at the time, and it was largely spearheaded by former Councillor Esther Dahlbeck. Her husband used to run the old Bombardiers, and so she had been talking about it for years that we need to start clearing these sidewalks. We've also had former councillors like Bob Finslin argue about it for years to support people living with disabilities. But the committee that passed it was all women. It was chaired by Jenny Van Sickle. It had Esther Dahlbeck and Ruth Ludwig.
And they all heard our show. That's what it was. It wasn't you. Yes, it must have been. Right. We're going to leave it right there. So, Mayor Jim Payne, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Robin. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up, what likely really happened to the Flying Dutchman of Lake Superior? Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If you've ever spent any time listening to old sailors spin sea stories, or a few hours in an opera house listening to Wagner, you know the story of the Flying Dutchman. That's the doomed vessel forever sailing the seas, never to make port, and offering any variety of terror to passing ships who dare to hail it. Well, Lake Superior is the queen of the unsalted seas and the cause of very real shipwrecks, so it only stands to reason that it would have a Flying Dutchman of its own. Or maybe not. Its name is the Bannockburn, though who's to say it's not the actual Dutchman? One person who can say, and most definitively so, is maritime historian Brendan Baylott, who has written and spoken extensively about the ship, and he joins us now. Welcome to Simply Superior, Brendan.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
So tell us all about it. But first, when I said it could be the Flying Dutchman, I assume I'm off my ship lore by a few centuries, yes?
Sure. Well, you know, the term comes down to us from the Dutch East India Company, you know, back in the 16th and 17th centuries, when they would make these long voyages from, India back to Northern Europe and England. And the sailors had a lot of time on those long, long voyages around South Africa. And they would tell these stories. And one of the popular ones was about the Flying Dutchman, which is a Dutch East India Company vessel that never arrived home. And yet they would constantly see her, and vessels reported her for years, out on the high seas. There were many sightings. And as her legend grew, so did her fame, until it became a favorite folks yarn. And it's been handed down in maritime circles for centuries. And of course, on the Great Lakes then, we applied the term to a number of different vessels that vanished seemingly without a trace, but, you know, are allegedly seen still sailing. And in the case of the Bannockburn, she has kind of earned that title.
So tell us about the Bannockburn, what we do know about it, and put it in the right century for me.
Sure. So Bannockburn is a fairly modern steel vessel. She was built in 1893 in England for use on the Great Lakes. So she was a Canadian vessel owned by the Montreal Transportation Company. Very staunch, built for the ocean, thought to really be in some ways unsinkable.
Yeah, well, they said the same thing about the Titanic, but go ahead, yes.
Very similar, but and she was lost in not a terrible storm, really, on the Great Lakes. One of the things that, you know, kind of has made her famous, though, is a book that was written in 1909 that became pretty famous by a guy named James Oliver Curwood. And Curwood was sort of the state author of the state of Michigan. And he wrote a bunch of books, kind of in the Jack London vein about, you know, northern wilderness adventure. But a lot of people don't know that his first book was called The Great Lakes and the Vessels That Plow Them. And in that book, you know, which was written only 7 years after the Bannockburn was lost, he called her the Flying Dutchman of the Great Lakes. And the term stuck. And he was, you know, a fanciful author. He wasn't trying to tell real history. He was trying to kind of paint a romantic picture of the Great Lakes. He not only called her the Flying Dutchman, but said that she had been seen trying to make port, you know, crossing the sea, you know, the seas hopelessly, you know, in these terrible tempests, and it stuck. Many authors went on to, you know, repeat that. And there were some reasons behind it. In my research, one of the things that I found is that the Bannockburn went down some of the middle of Lake Superior, but debris continued to be seen around the lakes for quite some time. There were claims even as long after as, you know, like 3 years later in 1905, there was a ship's deck and a pilot house found floating 15 miles off Whitefish Point. And they claimed it was from the Bannockburn. Of course, it wasn't. There were many ships that, you know, lost on Lake Superior each year then. But over the years, more and more debris sightings, everyone would say, well, that's a piece of the Bannockburn. Primarily because the newspapers of the day really ginned it up. I'll give an example. About 2 weeks after the Bannockburn was lost, a canvas life jacket was found floating off Grand Marais, Michigan, off a life-saving station there. And it was stenciled Bannockburn. And the newspapers got a hold of the story and said, well, it had blood stains on the straps, you know. And this was kind of par for the course for newsmen of the day. But it was from the Bannockburn, and there was other wreckage from her there. And then there's another account of an oar washing up on shore at Caribou Island, way out in the center of the eastern part of the lake. And that may be true, but by the time the newspapers got done with it, they said that the name Bannockburn was carved into the oar and etched in blood. So these kind of stories were propagated by the media quite a bit. And by the time James Oliver Curwood wrote his, you know, iconic book and mentioned her, she had become the Flying Dutchman, and all these sightings started to appear. Anytime somebody saw a ship, you know, out in a storm that they couldn't identify, it was, oh, there's the Bannockburn, you know, our Flying Dutchman.
We're speaking with Brendan Balod, author of Fathoms Deep But Not Forgotten, Wisconsin's Lost Ships, and also chronicler and, shall we say, myth-buster of the Bannockburn, Lake Superior's erstwhile Flying Dutchman. So back us up a little bit. It was built in Britain, and it came over here. What was it doing in its normal life? You know, where did it go? What did it haul? And then what happened?
Sure. The Bannockburn was, you know, being a Canadian vessel, at that time, the big cargoes for Canada were grain cargoes. Huge, huge prairies had just opened up in Manitoba and Alberta, Saskatchewan. And much of that cargo was coming out of a port called Port Arthur on Lake Superior that we now know as Thunder Bay. And the companies, particularly like the Montreal Transportation Company, would transport that grain primarily on the Great Lakes through these vessels. And they had a huge fleet. There were many, many vessels. Bannockburn would run up to Port Arthur through the Sioux Locks, and she would come back down through the Sioux Locks then, and usually either go to Port Colborne, or she would run all the way up to into Lake Ontario, and sometimes as far as Montreal, because she could pass through the Welland Canal and go right out into the seaway if she wanted to. And she was, you know, by all accounts, a pretty successful vessel. She had an identical sister ship named the Rosemont that was on the same routes as her, built also in England. And Rosemont never had any trouble. She lasted on the Great Lakes for many years, even went out and did some ocean service and came back to the lakes and was scrapped, I think, just before World War II, 1939, I think, at Sorel, Quebec. So probably wasn't anything really structurally wrong with the Bannockburn. Her sister had no troubles. But this storm she was out in was unusual in some ways. And also there's been a lot of new information made available that tells us, at least in part, what actually probably did happen to her, using modern information that wasn't available before the internet age.
In the time period, when was this storm?
1902. So the Bannockburn was out in kind of what we call the gales of November on Lake Superior. November of 1902, she was coming up the lakes on her final trip. She locked through the Sioux locks at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, November 19th, 1902. She was under the command of a 37-year-old captain named George Wood, who was actually fairly young to be a captain. And there were also 20 young sailors, almost all under 22 years of age on the vessel. So it was really a young crew. Some people say that, well, maybe their inexperience had something to do with it, but I doubt it. She arrived at Port Arthur and took on 85,000 bushels of Manitoba wheat. She made a quick turnaround, departed before midnight. But on her way out of Thunder Bay, she grounded on a mud or a sand bank. It wasn't hard grounding on rocks. It was like on sand. They had her free with a tug pretty quickly after only a couple hours. And on Monday, on the morning of Friday, November 21st, she got underway. She was heading for Midland, Ontario, by way of the Sioux Locks. So she was going to come down the shipping lane on Lake Superior. And that's an important point. On the Great Lakes, vessels, when they are going from point A to point B, they don't take roundabout ways, especially not steamships. They go on these vessel lanes because those are the shortest points between point A and point B. And if you don't stay on them, you waste fuel. And you don't get there as fast. And captains who couldn't stay on the shipping lanes, you didn't stay captains long. So the shipping lane from Port Arthur to the Sioux Locks is well established. And we know that, you know, they would have been on that shipping lane. So what happened to her? Well, a significant small storm came out over Lake Superior. And we know this because the Weather Bureau records exist for it. Even the synoptic weather maps exist. This disturbance was not very large. It was maybe 100 miles across, and it blew out of the northwest and came down across the lakes roughly over the shipping lane, right from Port Arthur all the way down to Sault Ste. Marie. Winds were about 50 miles an hour in that disturbance, which tells us that the waves were likely around 15 feet in height. That's pretty big. You wouldn't want to be out in 15-foot waves. But a ship, a modern ship like that, a modern steel vessel, can handle 15-foot waves. I've been out in 12-foot waves, you know, in a big steel boat on Lake Superior. And, yeah, we were all throwing up, but we weren't in any danger. To be out in that storm, she shouldn't have had problems, right? So what happened? Well, she was last seen about 40 miles off of Isle Royale on November the 27th. She was seen by the steamer Algonquin, and the Algonquin was another Canadian grain carrier. Her captain knew the Bannockburn well. He saw her in broad daylight and made no mistake that it was the Bannockburn. And she seemed to be holding her own, but it was a pretty bad storm, according to the captain. 15 footers, not something, you know, that you take lightly. He watched the Bannockburn closely because there was a heavy sea running, but there was no obvious signs of distress. Her captain, Captain McMaw, noted that, you know, he looked back at her just a few minutes later and couldn't see her. She was gone, went out of sight really quickly. And he speculated that she may have exploded her boilers, because how else could she have, you know, been there 1 second and not been there the next, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't happen on the Great Lakes, especially not on a modern ship. I mean, that's sort of clutching at straws on the captain's part, I think. There are no instances of ships just exploding their boilers on the Great Lakes in the early 1900s. That happened back in the, you know, 1850s, 1860s. But so what did happen to her? Well, in the following days after she was lost, there was a lot of speculation about where she was, because she didn't make it to the Sioux. About a week passed, and some people thought maybe she had, you know, been blown over to the eastern part of the lake and was hiding in some bay, you know. But they sent some tugs to look for her and never found her. There were a lot of sightings. So this is kind of what fed into Kerwood's, you know, how she was christened the Flying Dutchman, is First, she was reported to be ashore over on the eastern shore of the lake. But when they sent tugs over there, there was no ship there. And then they said she was aground on Caribou Island. But when they went to Caribou Island, there was no ship there. And then over the years, there were more sightings. But the smoking gun was when another ship, the Frank Rockefeller, it was later renamed the Meteor. And the Meteor, for those of you who are Lake Superior buffs, know that that's now a museum ship. It's Superior, Wisconsin. You can actually go on board the Meteor.
Right.
Well, the Meteor was the ship that found the last remains of the Bannockburn. And the Meteor was hauling an iron ore cargo off of the Keweenaw Peninsula. And she found a wreckage field off Standard Rock. And it was the Bannockburn's wreckage. And this was about, 50 miles south of where the Bannockburn was last seen. And there was no doubt about it. It was the Bannockburn's wreckage. So what's interesting is that if you draw a line in the direction the storm came from Port Arthur to where she was last seen by the Algonquin, to where the wreckage was found by the Meteor, to where the life jacket came ashore, that's a straight line in the direction of the storm. And it also goes right along the shipping lane that the ship was on. I looked at the records for the Sioux Locks vessel passages. So I have records of every vessel that passed through the Sioux Locks that whole week. And I know exactly which vessels were on the shipping lane to Port Arthur with the Bannockburn, both up and down. Turns out there's about 15 other ships out there that day, and only one saw her. And so what we know is that there are other vessels upbound that should have come in contact with her much sooner, like within the next hour after she was seen by the Algonquin, but they didn't see her. And so what we know from that, from the fact that these other vessels didn't see her and they were on the same track, is that she was lost quickly. She sank very fast. So from the time the Algonquin saw her to the time the next vessel that was upbound should have encountered her, less than 2 hours passed. So what happened? One of the things that I was able to find, in addition to finding all the Sioux Locks vessel passage records for that day, is an article that was in the Canadian papers, in the Montreal papers. And I'm going to read it to you. And this, to me, is the smoking gun. In connection with the loss of the steamer Bannockburn, the statement of a Kingston blacksmith, John Maloney, may be accepted as important. Maloney says, "I was the Montreal Transportation Company's blacksmith, and I braced the rudder quadrant on the Bannockburn as the hub was split. I have no doubt that it broke, and the combined efforts of the crew were insufficient to handle the rudder in a storm when the quadrant gave way and the vessel, being at the mercy of the sea, foundered." So I'll tell you first a little bit of kind of what that means. The quadrant is, sort of a metal bar that rides on this hub, and a gear goes through it, and it turns the rudder, right, to turn the vessel. And when he says that he braced it, what he means is you normally would replace something like that, right? But he was told by the company just to brace it. In other words, to, do a temporary fix. And it broke, he thought. Now, we didn't know that before, that the Bannockburn had a damaged rudder quadrant. It was late in the season, probably her last run of the season. You could see why they wanted to get in one more trip with her. Why would this blacksmith impugn his own work? Obviously, what he's doing is he's complaining. He's saying, they should have replaced it. Instead, they just had me brace it, If you've ever been in a following sea with big waves on Lake Superior, what you know is that it's really hard on the rudder, right? These big waves come and they tend to want to turn the vessel and they hit the rudder. And if you turn the wheel at all and that rudder takes one of those big waves on its side, that's a huge amount of force on the rudder. And you can imagine those big waves hitting the stern of the Bannockburn, and that would have certainly broken a rudder that had been kind of jury-rigged for a temporary fix. And what happens is the vessel turns sideways. It falls into the trough of the sea, as the old-time mariners would say. And once it's broadside to the waves, it's very hard to get the bow back up over the front wave and the stern back up over the rear wave at the same time.
Well, not to mention if you're having a Lake Superior storm in November.
Yeah. What happens then with a vessel that's carrying grain? Grain cargoes are notorious for shifting. And so there are many instances of grain-carrying vessels ending up on their sides because the cargo shifts. And then the men run below and try to trim the cargo with shovels. But, in the case of the Bannockburn, all it would have taken was for her rudder to break, she falls into the trough of the seas and she ends up on her side because the rudder or because the cargo shifted, she would have been on the bottom of the lake within, you know, 10 minutes probably. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have the smoking gun there with the blacksmith's account. And of course, nowadays, it took me 10 minutes to find that by looking up the word Bannockburn in the newspaper search engine.
Yeah, but for about 70 years, they didn't quite have the internet.
Exactly.
Or it was just a good story. Too good to have the facts interfere with, right?
Exactly.
Well, we're speaking with Brendan Baylod. He's the author of Fathoms Deep But Not Forgotten, Wisconsin's Lost Ships, and also chronicler and mythbuster of the Bannockburn, Lake Superior's erstwhile Flying Dutchman. So where did it go? Where is it now?
Well, it's a good question. One of the popular myths about it is that she hit Superior Shoal. It's a kind of an underwater island that is, you know, about the size of five city blocks mm-hmm. in the middle of nowhere on Lake Superior. And it's just under the surface. The problem is that Bannockburn was nowhere near Superior Shoal. The shipping lane was well west of Superior Shoal. And then further, of course, people have gotten out to Superior Shoal and done high-resolution surveys of it now and of the deep water around it, and there are no shipwrecks there. So, you know, that's debunked. But if you line up the debris sighting with where the life jacket came ashore with her last known position, and then you look at where, you know, the first ship that was on its way up should have encountered her, it gives you a pretty small box. So the question is, well, why hasn't she been found if it's such a small search grid? Well, that's a long ways from shore. That's, you know, 30, 40 miles out there from the nearest land. And when you're talking about doing a search that far out, you need a boat that gets, you know, doesn't get miles to the gallon, they get gallons to the mile. And so we're talking about, you know, an expedition that costs hundreds of dollars, if not thousands. You need a good side-scanning sonar. But the big thing is, you know, you can't use a side-scan sonar on Lake Superior in waves more than about 2 feet high, because you're towing it behind the boat and the waves tend to, you know, bounce it up and down, and then you won't see the bottom. So try to find a good 3-4 day window where there's 2 foot waves or less on Lake Superior. That doesn't happen real often. So getting the boat, getting the gas, getting the equipment, and then, you know, getting the time, the stars only line up like that every so often.
Well, I think you've just given a challenge to any intrepid would-be shipwreck discoverers out there. So despite your evidence, you think you ever will really bust the myth?
Well, I think the ship will be found. And once she's found, the myth is essentially busted, right? This ship is on the bottom of the lake. And I'm not a big fan of mythologizing these ships, because when you mythologize it, you know, like this, it loses sight of the fact that there is a real ship. There was a real disaster. There are 20 Canadian families that lost their loved ones, you know, and there are grandchildren and great-grandchildren out there, you know, who would still like to know what happened to their ancestor. And so...
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's similar to the Edmund Fitz, which, and usually people are, I hope usually, very respectful of it, and our area in particular, because we have families who are right here and still here today.
Exactly. It's a real ship with real people, and it will be found. And when it is, you know, I think it'll go a long way towards telling the story accurately and bringing some closure for a lot of Canadian families.
Absolutely. Although that's still not going to stop people from seeing whatever they want to see when they look out at Lake Superior.
Oh, she'll always be the Flying Dutchman of Lake Superior, even when she's found.
All right. We've been speaking with Brendan Baylod, coming to us from Madison. He is, I'm going to say, the definitive chronicler of the history, mystery, and legacy of Lake Superior's Flying Dutchman, the Bannockburn. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, we've been hearing all about supply chain issues. Last week, Linda Lagarde-Grover talked about them when she said copies of her new book were barely arriving on time for a reading she gave. So hunters may have to take a book with them in the deer stand because they may not have anything else to do.
Yeah, that hunting ammunition is really in short supply right now for the reasons that you mentioned with those supply disruptions, but also really due to surging demand for guns and ammunition since the COVID-19 pandemic. Gun dealers in the area are saying that they're really struggling to stock shelves as firearm sales have climbed due to the pandemic, to the civil unrest that we've seen, and also even the 2020 presidential election. Pat Kuchel, who's the owner of Superior Shooter Supply, said they had a shortage of shotgun ammunition for trap shooting over the summer. And then since then, you know, as bird hunters have been looking for pheasant, grouse, and waterfowl, there's been absolutely nothing for them, she said. And going into the rifle season, she said they haven't had any 30-30 shells in over a year, and they're rationing ammunition to one box per person and trying to keep a box of ammo for every caliber gun that they sell. But really, you know, we've seen 8 million new shooters in the last year, or new gun owners, according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And the FBI saw background checks for gun purchases climb 40% to a record almost 40 million last year. And in Wisconsin, it's pretty much the same. They saw background checks for handguns surge 174% last year, according to data from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. So this isn't something that's happening just in Superior. It's nationwide, it's statewide, it's everywhere right now. You know, with that demand, it's been really hard for people to find what they need for that hunting ammunition this fall.
Well, back to that deer stand. If you plan on spending the time drinking some local bottled water, that may not be happening either.
Well, yeah, the Bayfield County Board this week made a change to its county zoning ordinance so that a bottled water plant would no longer be permitted in industrial areas of the county there. And that change was made in response to a Duluth startup company's proposal to bottle and sell artesian water in the town of Clover. That proposal wouldn't be affected by this zoning change, but Crystal KLR, or Crystal Clear, had applied for a special permit in land that was zoned for residential and recreational use to bottle and sell water from the land there. And the county zoning committee rejected that permit as an unapproved use earlier this year. And the county's board of appeals upheld that decision, which is now being challenged in court by Crystal Myshak, who's the CEO and founder of Crystal KLR. And county board members wondered if this change might impact other projects in the county, like farms that may bottle and sell milk, or orchards that may look to bottle and sell cider. But the county zoning director, Rob Shearman, said this change would only apply to proposals seeking to bottle and sell water.
Well, and finally, the continuing saga of the wolf hunt. What's the latest update?
Well, the latest is that a Dane County judge last week temporarily barred Wisconsin from holding a wolf hunt and ordered the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to set a quota of zero wolves until the agency complies with its own rules. Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost said the way that the DNR was applying Wisconsin's wolf hunt law was unconstitutional. Republican Governor Scott Walker in 2012, and the DNR has been running hunts when the animal hasn't been listed as a federal endangered species under emergency rules. And basically, the judge disagreed with that, and the decision was hailed by wildlife advocacy groups who had brought a lawsuit against the DNR aiming to stop the wolf hunt. And hunters like Kansas-based Hunter Nation spoke out against this move by the judge's ruling, saying it was an activist judge acting beyond his authority, I guess, and that the laws and the rules are clear. He just doesn't agree with them. And he called on Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call and Governor Tony Evers to immediately appeal that judge's order so that the fall hunt can move forward.
All right. Well, Brooks on the Minnesota side and going up in altitude a bit, what's going on at Lutzen Mountain?
Yeah, Minnesota's largest ski resort, by many measures, wants to get even bigger. They've submitted plans to grow onto nearly 495 acres of federal land, adding 7 new chairlifts, dozens of new runs, and they say more business opportunity for the North Shore. Some locals disagree. They say that they should keep operations off of the forest and that they should do more with less and perhaps attract backcountry skiers. So what's been submitted is this plan to the Forest Service, which needs to either approve or deny a special use permit to allow Lutzen to expand onto the Superior National Forest. This is a common practice in Western states with big ski areas on federal land and in Montana and Colorado. But in Minnesota, opponents say, you know, we've got much rarer terrain like this, and it should be kept public and open for folks who don't necessarily have the means to pay for a lift ticket. Business groups, of course, Visit Cook County, Lutzen Tofte Tourism Organization, both say that, you know, the more people that Lutzen can bring in the winter, the better people's lives will be, frankly, on the North Shore. You know, a long-term success for Lutzen is long-term success for the North Shore. So a brewing, you know, jobs versus environment story on the North Shore, as we've seen before. And this one could take years to come to fruition. It'll be a while yet before the Forest Service makes its decision. And then Lutzen said it could be decades until they fully fulfill their expansion, but they'll start slowly as soon as they get permission, if they do.
All right. Well, if you're on top of Lutzen Mountain on a clear day, you might see some of our taconite operations, or maybe not. But if you could, what would you see?
Well, if you're driving up to Lutzen on Highway 61, you'll see the North Shore mining operation in Silver Bay, which we learned recently could be idled more frequently, putting more than 500 employees at risk of being temporarily out of a job now and then as the market swings. So what happened is Cleveland Cliffs CEO Lorenzo Gonsalves said recently that they plan to move high-grade pellet production to Minorca, which is a mine they acquired in their most recent acquisition of ArcelorMittal USA last year. That comes even though they spent $100 million on the Silver Bay North Shore mining operation. Gonsalves said he doesn't want to pay high royalties on the ore that is mined and shipped to Silver Bay to be processed and then shipped down the Great Lakes to be made into steel. Instead, he wants to use lower cost ore at another mine and said that that's his decision. I reached out to the company. They didn't respond, but all this came from an earnings call recently, and investors pressed him on the move, saying, you know, is it really cost prohibitive? Is it not possible to continue this? And he said, and I quote, "I will not use iron ore from the Peter Mitchell mine in Babbitt because I don't want to pay that royalty," end quote. So whether it's a bargaining tactic or not, it's unclear. Lorenzo Gonsalves, Cliff CEO, has been outspoken, to say the least, on earnings calls before. And so we'll see how this plays out as these plans progress.
All right. Well, visitors don't have to head up to the North Shore or the Range or Lutzen or the South Shore because there's plenty of vacation rentals popping up in Duluth. Or are there?
Well, slowly but surely, some more full-time vacation rental permits will be added to Duluth's limited supply. Right now, there is a cap of 60 vacation rental permits available for homeowners in Duluth. That doesn't count areas like downtown and Canal Park and other business districts where houses are few anyway. But recently, this week, the Duluth City Council unanimously approved a sweeping update to vacation rental rules that will eventually double that cap to 120 year-round vacation rental permits, and they've added a short-term permit. So there's no limit to these short-term permits, except that they're only valid for 21 nights a year. They can't be used more than 7 days in a row. And really, this was to sort of satisfy those folks who said, you know, we'd like to take part in this market, the sharing economy, you know, tap into this tourist income that Duluth has, and why do only 60 people get to do that? Of course, opponents to expanding vacation rentals say, well, we already have a housing crisis. We can't be taking housing out of the market. So this was seen as a compromise to say, hey, if you want to get out of town on grandma's marathon weekend, then, you know, you can rent out your house for 2-3 days at a time, or, you know, a couple weekends a year. So this was years in the making and came after a back and forth with the Planning Commission, you know, residents who spoke up, and a lot of, you know, just city staff working on finding this compromise. And it will be going into effect, and folks can start getting their short-term permits if they want, planning ahead for those busy Canal Park weekends pretty soon.
All right. And lastly, I understand there's a Duluth-based Star Tribune reporter who might be needing one of those Duluth vacation rentals, huh? You're leaving us, Brooks, to head down to the Star Tribune's mothership to cover Twin Cities and Minnesota business.
That's correct. Yeah, specifically, I'll be covering the food industry, companies like General Mills and Hormel, consumer packaged goods, as it's known, as well as 3M and some manufacturing as well. So I've loved my time in Duluth. I've been here for 5 years, and my son was born here. We bought our first house here, and I was to talk about it. Now I'm getting very wistful and emotional, but I have to thank you, Robin and Danny, for letting me talk your ears off every week for how long now, and it's been absolutely wonderful. As soon as we got here, we were so warmly welcomed by the community, and that has been true with news of our departure as well. So thank you so much, and yeah, look forward to your Cheerios and spam coverage from yours truly.
Yep, you will be missed, Brooks.
Absolutely, and by no means will you be a stranger. We've been speaking with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team and now the Star Tribune's business pages. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau, and again, maybe some of those business stories, at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter.
Do you want to hear my parting song I've got here?
You know, you have more than earned your right to make a request or dedication. So cue it up, Brooks.
The party's over.
On that note, that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
It's the same hook repeating. Grows more greater. And the walls could take a resonation. Laughter and confidence.